From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we start this hour with questions about a planned resort in Indonesia. Half of the funding is expected to come from loans from the Chinese government, and it will feature a Trump-branded golf course and hotels. White House Deputy Press Secretary Raj Shah was asked about it yesterday by Noah Bierman of the LA Times.
I'll have to refer you to the Trump Organization.
No, but I mean, the Trump Organization can't speak on behalf of the president as the president, the head of the federal government, the one who's responsible and who needs to assure the American people.
And
they
don't
have that responsibility.
But you're asking about a private organization's dealings that may have to do with a foreign government. That's not something that I can speak to.
The reporting on the resort from Agence France-Presse came this week as the president tweeted too many jobs in China were being lost, an about-face from past comments, and as both countries tussle over trade. Let's bring in Noah Bierman of the Los Angeles Times. You heard him ask the question. And Noah, what were you getting at with it? Reassure the American people about what?
Well, there were a lot of questions raised by this report, including, some ethics experts said it had some questions about the constitutional emoluments clause being raised, which the Constitution basically says that the president can't profit from foreign governments through his role as the president. And there's an argument to be made, at least, that this could compromise that.
Well, and you mentioned ethicists. There's Richard Painter, who was an ethics lawyer for former President George W. Bush, said the project was problematic. I would have advised him to sell the hotel and other holdings. But didn't the president pledge that he would not have any new business dealings with Trump Company? This deal, as we understand it, started in 2015.
Yeah, that's correct. And I mean, that this story speaks to some of the big questions in the president's own declaration, which he made before taking office, about how he would interpret his own ethics standards. But as we can see from this project, what is the definition of a new project? And when something is financed, does that make it new if the financing is crucial to getting it off the ground? In this case, they might argue that it's not new, but some of the same issues end up being raised. So maybe that safeguard isn't quite safe enough.
Well, and you talk about the financing. The Chinese government is said to be about to invest $500 million in this MNC Lido City, which is what this lifestyle resort is being called. And this does come in the same week where the president puzzled so many by saying that he was going to help ZTE, the Chinese company. He was going to save jobs there. This is a company that his administration had imposed penalties on for violating sanctions.
That's right. There was a $1.2 billion fine for violating sanctions on Iran and North Korea. And it was also, ZTE is at least in part, a government-owned company. So it's very close to the government, as are a lot of major companies in China. And beyond the sanctions issue, a lot of people had questions. The president was tweeting about Chinese jobs, which is really startling given how much he's tweeted that the Chinese are responsible for taking American jobs. And that's the basis in a lot of ways of the America First policy that the president has run on and governed on as president.
Look, we mentioned the ZTE story. It's certainly raising eyebrows that President Trump, talked about saving Chinese jobs, and the news comes out that China is investing $500 million into a project that includes, Trump-branded buildings and golf courses. But is there a direct line?
We don't know, and this may just be a coincidence, but it does underline the problems that the president has, where he has a business that depends heavily on the Trump brand. It continues to be owned by the Trump family. He still is profiting from this business, even if he isn't directly controlling it day to day.
Well, it's interesting because the company, the Trump Organization, is controlled by the president's sons, while President Trump still owns the company. But according to Agence France-Presse, the head of the Indonesian company involved, MNC, traveled to Washington in January 2017 and New York to have a design review with President Trump and to go to the inauguration. So the president can't say he's hands-off on this project.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very difficult issue for the White House, and it's something that they've been reluctant to respond to. As you heard at the beginning of the segment, they referred all questions to the Trump Organization. And while the Trump Organization can speak about their business practices, they can't speak on behalf of the president in his role as president, who's, you know, has a different responsibility. And that's been one of the frustrating things to a lot of questions that have come up about Trump Organization practices and businesses.
Noah Bierman, White House reporter for the LA Times, will link you to the reporting in Agence France-Presse at herenow.org. Noah, thank you.
Thanks very much for having me. Good talking to you, Robin.
A General Motors plant in Lordstown, Ohio, is preparing to lay off workers and reduce shifts starting next month. The factory makes the Chevy Cruze, which is a sedan that has seen slumping sales in recent years as Americans instead buy SUVs, trucks, and crossovers. Lordstown Mayor Arno Hill joins us now. Mayor, General Motors has said that up to 1,500 employees could be impacted. Do you have any more information?
I do not. I know that they have offered some of the employees employment in Spring Hill, Tennessee, where they make two SUVs. So I'm sure it'll probably be 1,500 here, but I don't know how many will actually be laid off.
And is it your sense that this move is just about demand for larger cars rather than smaller cars like the Chevy Cruze?
Absolutely. You know, it's a great product, but if you read, you know, Ford is going down to two car models, the Mustang and another, I believe, a Focus, and you know, people are going to the larger vehicles because the gas is cheaper, so the market's not there.
Did you offer GM anything to stay in town, keep these jobs there?
No, we have not. You know, we had three shifts running probably a year and a half ago, and now we'll have two now and one by the middle of June. I don't know anything we could possibly offer because they're not going to build cars and just have them sitting on the dealer's lots.
So when you look back at the history of this plant, by the way, it employed 15,000 people at the peak back in 1985. After what's happening now, it looks like it'll be around 1,500 people.
Yeah, they'll be down about 10%. A lot of it is they subbed several items out. So that's when they used to do everything, including wheel and tire assembly, seat assembly. They used to do everything in the plant, and they've subbed a lot of it out. So that's why they only have 1,500 workers on one shift.
So what has that loss of workers done to Lordstown?
Our revenue is down. We are fortunate that when they were running well, we put money aside. We should be okay for this year. We'll take another look next year. We do have a couple other projects going on here in town which have help the village coffers.
And what are workers who may be laid off telling you? Do you think that they are going to go to, let's say, Spring Hill, Tennessee, or do you think that they'll stick around and try to find another job in Lordstown?
I think if there's people who do have family around here, they may try to hang around and hopefully see if we get a second shift or even maybe another product down the road. You know, the rumor mill is running rampant. You know, someone said that they may run this model year out, and then after that, you know, some people say, well, maybe they'll shut down and they'll retool the plant. I do know that back in the 90s when they did do some upgrades, they did try to build some flexibility into the assembly line so they could run a bigger product if they choose to do so.
Now, there is another employer expected to come to town. That would be TJX Companies, which is working on plans to develop a regional distribution center there. What would that mean for jobs?
They're telling us 1,000 jobs. It'll actually be between 1,200 and 1,400 jobs. Distribution center distributing to 300 home goods stores. And, you know, granted the wages may not be the same as the General Motors, we could always use the jobs. We also have a natural gas-fired electric generation plant, which is getting ready to come online in the next 3-4 months, which at its peak, it had at one time 900 skilled tradespeople building it on site. They'll probably employ 20 when it's done, but that's 20 more than what we had.
And are you expecting to offer any tax incentives to companies like TJX that want to come into town?
Yes, we have not discussed tax incentives other than in a very general sense. When they come in, they would have to deal with the village council and also with the village school board, because most of the taxes you abate are with the school. And depending on what level of tax abatement they would like, we could possibly bring the school board into play on that.
How long have you been in Lordstown?
I moved here in 86. I'm in my 19th year as mayor.
Wow. And what is it that you like so much about it there?
It's a great community. And I enjoy a good challenge. You know, I lived here. I actually grew up just about 10 miles north of here. And, you know, the weather's great. We're close to Lake Erie. We're halfway between Cleveland and Pittsburgh. You know, we can go. There's a lot to do around here. And we're within 60% of a day's drive of the U.S. anybody in the U.S. population.
You just got to keep those jobs there, basically.
We are trying our best. You know, the Mahoning Valley lost a lot of steel jobs about 41 years ago, and, you know, we still haven't totally recovered, but we're trying our best to try to look at the bright side.
It's Mayor Arno Hill of Lordstown, Ohio. Mayor Hill, thank you for joining us.
Appreciate the call. Thank you.
Among the books that never leave my nightstand, anything by Mary Carr. The Liars Club, her memoir of growing up, the daughter of an alcoholic father and mother, raped by a babysitter. The New York Times' Michiko Kakutani called it one of the most dazzling and moving memoirs in years. Then had to find more words to describe Mary's lit about her own alcoholism and recovery and conversion to Catholicism. Well, now Mary Carr has a new poetry collection. It's also memoir, and our talk about it may not be suitable for all ears. It includes a poem dedicated to the late and lionized writer David Foster Wallace. His biographer, D.T. Max, says Foster Wallace's opus, Infinite Jest, was written just to impress Mary Carr. But in their brief relationship in the 90s, he abused her, then stalked her. He killed himself in 2008. Her poems about him sear the eyes. But he is just a small part of this book. There's more on Texas, New York, her relationship with God. Mary Carr's new collection is Tropic of Squalor. She's also a professor of literature at Syracuse University. Mary, good to talk to you again.
Hey, Miss Robin. How are you?
I'm good. And I'm going to admit, at the risk of looking stupid, that we wanted to talk to you for you. We didn't even know you'd had a volatile relationship with David Foster Wallace.
I had a relationship. He had the volatile part. One reason I finally spoke up about the violence is I have so many young women who write things that I read. They imagine that I could never be in a situation with somebody who is violent. And I've got to just say, after 20 years of silence about it, at a certain point, I feel like I was complicit with somebody who beat my ass and was a torment. I felt awful when he died. I thought it was terrible. But I've been a writer before he was born. You know, some people consider me a footnote in the biography of this guy who's seen as this sort of sainted sage who tragically could not live in this wicked world. And he just happens to be a guy who was brutal to me.
Yeah. You say you were complicit, but the literary world was complicit. His biographer was complicit. David Foster Wallace threw a table at you, threw you out of the car in a strange neighborhood.
Those aren't the worst things he did. I mean, the worst thing he did was climb up the side of my house onto my bedroom balcony and also follow my son home when my son was five and also try to buy a gun to kill my husband. And the biographer saw letters where these things are discussed. It's not like this stuff was not known.
And treated it as something that was dramatic about his
personality. I think what D.T. Max said about it was that it made his violence made him more, quote unquote, fascinating. You know, I just reading stuff from the Me Too movement and seeing so many young women in my office who carry so much shame. And like every other woman, I blamed myself and I was going to, you know, fix it. And I was, you know, it's a very common saga. I had a lot of suicides in my life. And my mother was suicidal or claimed she was. Now I realize she was homicidal. But it's something, you know, is a bad, sad part of my past that I've only recently sort of come forward with. And it was, I was kind of scolded by a handful of people about it because it was seen as though I were being unkind or something, which is what happens to a lot of women. But I've got to say, so many young women reached out to me online who had been hit in the face by him or lied to or students of his he slept with that I am glad I spoke up.
Well, one of the poems begins, "I hope you've been taken up by Jesus." And so we'll We'll let people read them. What else are you saying with these poems? Lots about your dad?
My dad worked at an oil refinery, but also in the oil fields. Yes, ma'am. No, I think it's for me, the book was sort of like Tropic of Squalor was the joke name we had for my hometown, which was this swampy little backwater in East Texas where there's flaming industrial towers and snakes and alligators. And, you know, the Ku Klux Klan had fish fries on Sundays. Mm. And it was a kind of hell for me. It was a kind of inferno. I was a sensitive, dorky kid with my head in a book. And I feel like the book is, in a way, about a journey out of darkness into the light.
Mm. I'm just reading one line. 3 gas stations in this town, now chemo centers, so you needn't drive to Houston. Those oil fields and the cancers that are there. And
honestly, yeah. The cancer rate in my hometown, it looks like Chernobyl. The number of people I know, I mean, I had 2 friends die of leukemia before I was in the 6th grade. And it is true that they turn these gas stations into chemo centers. It's just so strange.
A lot here about your relationship with God.
I am a prayer, Miss Robin. I pray. Somebody kind of dared me, you know, why don't you pray every day for 30 days and see if your life gets better? I don't know that it always changes things, but I know that it kind of always changes me, and sometimes I change things. It's not like the magic eight ball where the thing floats up to the surface, but sometimes I get a very quiet leaning kind of in the middle of my chest, and something I've been gnawing on or worrying about, it just kind of vanishes, or the bubble gets in the middle somehow, so I'm able to make a decision about something. So people always ask me, what does the voice of God sound like? So I wrote this poem called The Voice of God that opens with like the kind of thing God says to me. Sadly, I never get the lottery ticket number, but here it goes. 90% of what's wrong with you could be cured with a hot bath, says God through the manhole covers. But you want magic. To win the lottery you never bought a ticket for. Tenderly, the monks chant, embrace the suffering. The voice never panders, offers no 5-year plan, no long-term solution, no edicts from a cloudy white beard hooked over ears. It is small and fond and local. Don't look for your initials in the geese honking overhead, or to see through the glass even darkly. It says the most obvious stuff. Like, put down that gun. You need a sandwich.
By the way, is that literal?
Oh, no, I've never had a gun okay. And gone out. There's a reason I don't own a firearm.
Well, but I wonder there when you say this voice of God is coming up like steam from the manholes. Really, as you walk through New York, are you hearing God?
Well, Robin, most of the time I'm not such a nice person. If you see me on the subway and the air conditioning is out, like somebody is screaming or some guy is going to the bathroom on the right in front of you. If you just say, you know, God bless the guy going to the bathroom right in front of me, it's amazing what happens. It's literally you can become sort of curious about somebody. So I actually do walk around a lot of times because otherwise I'm just such a jerk. I just think for me, prayer is like a part of a whole series of psychological corrections I need.
Well, there's much of that here. There's just little observations. Discomfort food for the unwhole. I think a whole
If you've been in Whole Foods, you've been in a long line. It's interesting because nobody believes in God, but everybody believes paying $7 for an apple will keep you from dying.
And everybody believes in their phone.
That's right.
And so you have each head bent over a shining phone. Through these squares of light, we tap, tap with opposable thumbs and don't see what's all around us.
Right. Behind us stretch rows of iced Gulf shrimp. New Zealand lamb, the Russian sturgeons, glistening black eggs, dewy orchids, misty from Brazil. So much from so many for so few, and at such spectacular cost. And yet we cannot lift our heads from our hands to look around. We cannot stop ourselves. Each face hung forward off the neck of the corpse each self devours.
Ugh.
didn't make us look so good.
No, I'll never look at a line at Whole Foods the same way again. Mary Carr, so you've been in a certain kind of passage. What does putting this out do for you?
Well, you know, Robin, I'll be honest with you. I feel like I'm, you know, in my 60s, and I feel like until the past 18 months, I feel like I was like this. I've been a feminist since I was 8 years old, but I feel like I've been an Uncle Tom. I feel like all my life I have pandered to men in a way that I wasn't aware of, and that I have totally changed my mind about what's going on in the world. When people used to tell me there was a rape culture, you know, it's not a new idea that it's bad to rape people. But you know what, Robin? It's kind of a new idea that it's bad to rape people. Mm-hmm. It kind of is. And there are terrible things that happen. I was raped as a child. There are terrible things that happen to children. But I'm thinking about when I was 21 years old, I came to New York City, and I was in a room with many of the great poets, many of the great writers I wanted to meet. I had a great teacher, a guy named Etheridge Knight. James Wright was there, and Galway Connell, and Alice Walker was there, and Denise Levertov. And I was there babysitting for Etheridge's kids. And Galway Connell, who's teaching at Princeton, comes into the kitchen and puts my hand on his unit. And I left. I left that the room. So it's not just the rape. It's the number of times you're driven from a place. You don't have an opportunity you should have simply because of your gender.
That's Mary Carr. Her latest collection of poetry is Tropic of Squalor. Mary, thank you so much, as always.
Thanks for having me, Miss Robin.
Palestinians mourned their dead today after yesterday's violent clashes with Israeli troops in Gaza. Dozens were killed in those clashes. NPR's Steve Inskeep has just left Gaza. He's back in Israel now and joins us in transit. And Steve, tell us what you've seen there.
Well, it's been an interesting few days. We were there on Sunday prior to the eruption of violence and returned again this morning. Our colleague Daniel Estrin, of course, has been there throughout. And what you saw about 24 hours ago was a series of attempts of people walking across no man's lands, walking across fields, ranging across wide areas, trying to reach a border fence, and Israeli troops opening fire. You had a smaller scale version of that today. We did see quite a number of people at a particular protest area, perhaps hundreds of people spread out across fields, almost like a military unit sweeping toward fences, and now and again an Israeli military shot ringing out, but nothing quite like the carnage of yesterday.
What are Palestinians saying about all of this?
Well, Palestinians are making it clear that they intend in some way to continue the protest. There were more people showing up today and more people expressing themselves in ways that I think many of us would find profoundly offensive. We talked to this one young man, 19 years old, who'd made a kite that was designed to fly over Israeli forces, he said, and catch fire, and it had a swastika on it, which he said conveyed exactly the meaning that you would think, that he wants Jews to burn. This is what he said.
You spoke with the Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus, the international spokesman for the Israeli Defense Forces, and you asked him about what happened yesterday. Let's listen.
What we had yesterday were armed terrorist attacks against Israeli targets, and there were two locations where Hamas terrorists attacked Israeli troops with live ammunition and with AED.
So he's saying that Israeli troops were responding to attacks from Hamas. Is that true? Was it all Hamas yesterday?
Oh, okay. Let's unpack this a little bit. He makes this assertion there were two locations that there were Hamas attacks. We cannot confirm or deny that. If they happened, they weren't where our reporters were. That doesn't mean they didn't happen. But the key thing here is there were said to be about 13 different places that large numbers of people attempted to breach border fences that Israel has put around Gaza. So even if this claim is true, the overwhelming majority of people involved were not armed Hamas fighters. They certainly were in many cases motivated or encouraged by Hamas, which is very powerful in Gaza. But there's something more going on here. You do have a situation where 1.2 2.8 million people are living in terrible conditions in what is obviously, as soon as you arrive, severe poverty compared to Israel right next door, with the smell of sewage everywhere, with a polluted Mediterranean Sea nearby, with a shattered economy, and with great difficulty even leaving Gaza because of Israeli fences and security checkpoints. And so there is a series of complaints. And there is the broader Israeli-Palestinian conflict over land looming in the background as well. So there is a lot going on in this protest besides the allegations of the use of weapons by Hamas.
That's NPR's Steve Inskeep, just out of Gaza. Steve, thank you so much.
Glad to do it.
Yesterday's Supreme Court ruling striking down a federal ban on sports gambling means states can now legalize betting on sports. The American Gaming Association estimates that illegal sports betting adds up to about $1.5 billion a year, so the ruling opens the door to what could be big business. Joining us now is Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the fantasy sports site DraftKings announced yesterday that it's already planning to start accepting wagers. Are there other gaming sites already poised to take advantage of this ruling?
Well, the first places that will really likely take advantage of it will be the actual casinos and racetracks in New Jersey. Remember, that's where this whole legal fight began.
Right.
But yes, depending on how many states follow New Jersey's lead, there likely will be plenty of other sites. The stock market seems to have taken a shine to a few companies that have well-established overseas gambling operations. Companies like Stars Group, which is a Canadian company that operates the Poker Stars brand. And in Britain, there is William Hill, which is one of the biggest betting shop companies and also operates a very big online gambling operation. In fact, William Hill has spent several years building a bar adjacent to a horse racing track in New Jersey in anticipation of this ruling. So a lot of people are trying to sniff out who the real beneficiaries will be.
And what about the sports leagues? What does this mean for the NCAA, the NBA? I see that in the past, the NFL, for example, has lobbied against allowing this kind of thing.
You're right. Many in the sports leagues were against this, but now that it looks like it's going through, the thinking is that they might as well capitalize on the potential revenue. And there really is a lot of revenue potentially to be made. And there's also a big potential to sell the data on all the statistics the leagues collect. And finally, when you think of a game from a fan's perspective, a lot of times if a game's a blowout, we'll say the Celtics are beating the Cavaliers by 30 points.
Let's just say that that happened. I'm not sure
if
that did
just
the other day, right?
Play for the hometown audience. And normally a fan might turn off that game and go to bed early, but say you have a bet on LeBron James scoring 30 points or more than 30 points. You know, it could be enough to keep fans more engaged than they would be otherwise. So there's a lot of potential upside for the leagues from this.
And what about states? Obviously, Nevada not so happy because they kind of had a monopoly on this sort of thing. But what about other states? They're going to get revenue from this as well.
Yeah, there certainly is the potential for a lot of revenue. I've seen estimates that the total amount gambled on sports could be in the hundreds of billions of dollars. There, you know, still a lot of questions open about what it will all look like, but there are plenty of states that are likely to follow suit: Mississippi, Pennsylvania, New York, Delaware, and West Virginia. And you know, the number of states is expected to possibly be in the double digits by the end of the year.
Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And now a word that's caused great pain. Earlier this year, students at Princeton University protested when a professor used the N-word in a class about hate speech. He later canceled the course. There was a similar incident last semester at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. One African-American historian at Smith wants to help teachers address the N-word and what it represents in a way that's safe for students. As New England Public Radio's Karen Brown reports, she has a unique viewpoint on that word. And a warning, this story of necessity has language that's offensive.
Most people know exactly what I'm referring to when I say the N-word. But even if you imagine the word in your head, there can be a visceral difference between hearing the euphemism and hearing the slur itself.
There's all kinds of other words that mean black that maybe aren't even nice words, like pickaninny, you know, but I can say that right now. So what is rooted in the specific history of this specific word?
Elizabeth Storter Pryor has been thinking about the N-word for a long time, and she's in a unique position to do so. Not only is she a Smith College historian of race in America, she's also the child of a white Jewish mother and a black father who happened to be Richard Pryor. The iconic comedian who rose to fame in the 1970s was one of the first performers to pepper the N-word throughout his routines. In this one on how whites and blacks interact with the police, we've bleeped out the N-word and, well, a few other words, too.
Cross to the police live in your neighborhood, see? And you be knowing them as Officer Timpson.
Hello, Officer Timpson. Going bowling tonight?
Don't know him like that. See, white folks get a ticket, they pull over.
Hey, officer, yes, glad to be of help. Here you go.
Got to be talking about, I am reaching into my pocket for my license.
And my father really made public the fact that African Americans use the N-word with each other. He used the N-word in a way that was subversive and defiant.
A lot of niggas ain't scared. You know, like when the Martians landed and white folks got scared. I'm a, golly, I'll tell you, just a big old helicopter thing came down and landed. Jesus Christ. Nothing can scare me. After 400 years of this shit.
Elizabeth Pryor was about 7 years old when this comedy album came out. It was decades later, as a new professor at Smith, that she unexpectedly had to make her own decision on using the word publicly. A student in her Civil War history class quoted a joke from a movie.
They repeated a line from Blazing Saddles that uses both a disparaging word for people of Chinese descent and the N-word.
All right, we'll give some land to the n**s and the ch**s, but we don't want the Irish.
And I was like, oh, and I was looking around at this classroom of mine, which was mostly white students, but some African-American students, and myself, who's African-American. And I was like, whoa, 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 whoa.
The next lecture, she told the class the N-word was off limits.
Nobody ever said it again, but we didn't really do, it was a missed opportunity. There was great intellectual work we could have been doing in the class, and we weren't doing it because I had censored the word.
That was the last time she taught a course about racism without addressing the N-word head on. Now she tells her students on the first day of class they will read texts that include the slur. They will see it on PowerPoints, but they will not discuss the word until halfway through the course. That's when she teaches the N-word's historical journey from a label for slave to a demeaning epithet, and she lets students talk about their own interactions with the word.
It really does take several weeks of the students doing group work together, having some difficult conversations about other topics before you can even get them to have this conversation with each other.
Although she's been teaching and writing about the N-word for almost a decade, she still gets nervous every semester before the first N-word lecture, as do her students.
The black students are terrified that I'm not going to take care of them, that I am going to allow white students to say whatever they need to for their intellectual process. The white students are terrified that they're going to put their foot in their mouths in ways that they can't even predict because racism is so subtle and so deep. They're afraid that they are going to inadvertently reveal like a dark thought.
And if it's this awkward in a class with a black historian who specializes in the N-word, it's no less confusing elsewhere on college campuses. Last spring, a white professor at Smith College was removed from teaching an English class after reciting the N-word in a poem and then suggesting students who were upset leave the class. He later apologized in the student newspaper. Elizabeth Pryor says one thing that could diffuse this kind of tension is teaching about the word at a younger age. After all, most American teenagers have had to read Huckleberry Finn, which uses the N-word 219 times.
I kind of expected my students to come to me by college to have already had these conversations, and they haven't.
This spring, Pryor will be giving workshops to middle and high school teachers on ways to broach the N-word in class without making students feel unsafe or excluded. She's also writing a book about the epithet, partly from her perspective as Richard Pryor's daughter. Her father famously changed his views on the N-word after a trip to Kenya when he came to see the slur as more demeaning than comedic.
I was leaving, and I was sitting in a hotel, and a voice said to me, he said, look around, what do you see? And I said, I see all colors of people doing everything. And the voice said, do you see any n***s? I said, no. And I said, you know why? Because there aren't any. And it hit me like a shot, man. I started crying and I was sitting there. I said, yeah, I've been here 3 weeks. I haven't even said it. I haven't even thought it. And it made me say, oh, my God, I've been wrong. I said, I ain't gonna never call another black man.
And I remember he pulled me aside and told me he was never going to use the N-word again.
And to her knowledge, he never did. For Here and Now, I'm Karen Brown.
And now we have to mark the passing of a larger-than-life literary figure. There's a good chance you can picture him, a pale three-piece suit, two-tone shoes, silk tie, keen eye. As a reporter in the forefront of new journalism, Tom Wolfe chronicled the hippies in his electric Kool-Aid acid test, the space program, in The Right Stuff. When he turned to fiction, his Bonfire of the Vanities torched the bestseller list. Tom Wolfe has died at 88. NPR arts correspondent Lynn Neary joins us now. And Lynn, your first thoughts on hearing that?
Well, my first thought really was that the literary world has not only lost a great writer, it's lost a great character. Tom Wolfe was an absolutely iconic figure in literary and publishing circles, and that is since the 1960s. As you mentioned, he was a very dapper man. He grew up in the South, and he brought a little bit of that Southern tradition to the gritty streets of New York with his signature style. He dressed in white, often in a three-piece suit, pretty much always complete with a white hat. And when asked about this sartorial choice once, he called it neo-pretentious. He was very good at coming up with those kinds of phrases that really hit home. One that was famous was the radical chic of the 1960s, which he used to describe the wealthy New Yorkers who were hanging out with radicals like the Black Panthers.
Like Leonard Bernstein.
Yes, exactly. The me decade about the 1970s, pushing the envelope. He was quite a wordsmith. Yeah,
but here he is talking about his early work.
I've always felt that if you're a reporter, you can't also be a PR man for the person you're writing about. And that's the worst kind of giving in to social pressure.
Yeah, that's him speaking about his book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which is when he traveled with Ken Kesey in the 60s and the Merry Pranksters, the hippie movement. It was described as new journalism. Remind us what that meant.
Well, new journalism, he was one of a group of writers. It included Gay Talese, Joan Didion, Hunter Thompson, Norman Mailer. They created these searing, funny, very insightful pieces about life in the 60s, starting in the 60s. They ushered in the new journalism at that time. It was also known as narrative nonfiction. It was a style of writing that combined reporting skills with a narrative style drawn from fiction. And I think Wolfe was really one of the best-known practitioners because his style of writing was so distinctive. I remember reading the candy-colored Tangerine Flake Streamline Baby, which was one of his
cars.
Early essays. It grew out of what seems like a simple assignment to report on car designers in California. I don't remember the details, but I remember my reaction to it. It was like nothing I had ever read before. It was a funny, wild ride of a read. And I was one of many who wanted more of that at the time.
Well, I had read somewhere that he went out and he did. He was assigned this as a reporter to cover some car convention. And he did it in sort of the way that, you know, everybody expected. And then he said, no, I want to blow the roof off this. And then he did it his way, which was that was the result. People might remember his writing for Rolling Stone. That's where The Right Stuff, his book about the Mercury astronauts, first appeared. It became the hit movie. And here's a scene from the movie based on the book. Gordon Cooper, played by Dennis Quaid, is asked by the press who he thinks the best pilot he ever saw was. It includes a now famous phrase. Let's listen.
And some of them are still out there somewhere, doing what they always do, going up each day in a hurtling piece of machinery, putting their hides out on a line, hanging it out over the edge, pushing back the outside of that envelope and hauling it back in.
There it is, pushing the envelope.
Pushing the envelope. And I think it was a phrase from aviation, but it got popular after he used it.
Yeah. Well, the Mercury astronauts were, I mean, people have to remember, they were mega heroes of the early 60s. I mean, there were spreads in Life magazine about everything, their training, their families, their hobbies. And then when Tom Wolfe turned his eye on them, he saw this group of guys. They had been thrust into the spotlight. They had a little idea of what was ahead of them. They had been test pilots. And as astronauts, they kind of lost control of their vehicle when they went up in that little sort of a, you know, can. They didn't have any control over it. And some of them really withered as a result, while others like John Glenn, for example, emerged as major leaders. Mm-hmm. But the one that he really focused on was not an astronaut. It was Chuck Yeager, the test pilot, who never became an astronaut, but he also never had to give up control over his own plane or his own life.
Well, Lynn Neary, we have to say that Tom Wolfe had his critics. Norman Mailer wasn't a pal. He also was criticized for his portrayal of blacks in Bonfire. James Wood, the great critic, wrote, Wolfe has subjects and people and yards of flapping exaggeration. No real human can be found in his fiction because it was always so outsized. But he made no bones about it. That's what he wanted, excitement.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that if you look at nonfiction writing now, I think you can't help but say it's been hugely influenced by him and the other new journalists, as they were called at that time, by this idea of narrative nonfiction. Much nonfiction now reads like a novel, and the story pulls in the reader, and yet most of them really are based in fact. Now, you're right. It's been criticized for stretching the facts sometime, and a lot of people have tried their hand at nonfiction, but I would say none have done it quite as successfully as Tom Wolfe did.
Yeah. NPR arts correspondent Lynn Neary helping us remember writer Tom Wolfe, who died yesterday in New York at 88. Big life. Lynn, thank you.
It was good to be with you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now. Mm-hmm.